Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasaya Gurudeva Shrimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Prachadane Nirvishesha Shunyavani Paschachade Shatadane Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasadi Gauravakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 20, Verse 53.
Tebhyas chaikai kasasvasya Dehyas amsam adat aja Yatta samadhi yogadhi Tapo vidya viraktimat Tebhyas chaika kaikasha svasya Dehasyam sam adat ajaha Yatta samadhi yogadhi Tapo vidya viraktimat. Tebhya, to them, cha, and ekai kasha, each one, svasya, of his own, dehasya, body, angsam, part, adat, gave, aja, the unborn Brahma. Yet, which taught that samadhi, deep meditation, yoga, concentration of the mind, riddhi, supernatural power, tapa, austerity, vidya, knowledge, virakti, renunciation, mat, possessing. Translation, to each one of these sons, the unborn creator of the universe gave a part of his own body, which was characterized by deep meditation, mental concentration, supernatural power, austerity, adoration, and renunciation. Purport, the word virakima in this verse means possessed of the qualification of renunciation. Spiritual realization cannot be attained by materialistic persons. For those who are addicted to sense enjoyment, spiritual realization is not possible. In Bhagavad Gita, it is stated that those who are too attached to seeking material possessions and material enjoyment cannot reach yoga samadhi, absorption in Krishna consciousness. Propaganda that one can enjoy this life materially and at the same time spiritually advance is simply bogus. The principles of renunciation are four. 1, to avoid illicit sex life. 2, to avoid meat eating. 3, to avoid intoxication. And 4, to avoid gambling. These four principles are called tapasya, or austerity. To observe the mind in the supreme in Krishna consciousness is the process of spiritual realization. Thus in the Bhaktivedanta purports of the third canto, 20th chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Conversation Between Maitreya and Vidura. Translation, to each one of these sons, the unborn creator of the universe gave a part of his own body, which was characterized by deep meditation, mental concentration, supernatural power, austerity, adoration, and renunciation. So, this whole chapter has described the creation of Brahma, which is the Visarga, or the secondary creation. The primary creation is done by the Supreme Lord himself in the form of glancing over material energy and agitating Prakriti to produce elements or manifest elements which form into universes. And once the universes are formed, the Supreme Lord, as Garbhadakshay Vishnu enters, and from him Brahma is born. And then Brahma carries out the secondary creation, which has been described here in the form of the living entities. Now, of course, the living entities also need places. And we see there's a variety of living entities like Gandharvas and Apsaras and Kimpurushas and Manus and human beings and Devatas, etc., which were previously described here. So they all have to have places to live because they're all different and they need different environments, just as the fish live in the water and then the human beings and other animals live on the land and the birds in the air, etc. So they require particular places. And therefore, the lokas are also described. The creation of the different lokas by the Supreme Lord are described, particularly in the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam, where we have a description of Bhumandala, upper planetary systems, and lower planetary systems. So these are the places where the living entities with their bodies reside. And they do two things. One is they survive and enjoy, which is their material propensity. And if they are intelligent enough, the human species, then the Lord also gives another choice, and that is they can follow process of Dharma. And so some of the sages which are created by Brahma establish that as Manus. They establish the process of Dharma. And throughout the day of Brahma, 14 times they keep changing and establishing their lines so that the Varnashram system is established for the human being, which regulates the human being. And through that we get Artha Dharma Kama, and then finally Moksha. So the kings, the Manus, are especially interested in establishing the Dharma for the population in general. Because we know that the population in general, they're a little bit lazy and they're not so spiritually inclined. So they just want to live, raise their families and enjoy a little bit. So Artha Dharma Kama is for that purpose, to regulate that enjoyment and gradually, imperceptibly, raise the population up towards sattva-gun over many, many, many births. And when they become sattvic, the character of sattva-gun is to naturally manifest atma-jnana, or knowledge of the atma. I am not the material body. So in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna describes very nicely the character of sattva-gun, and he particularly mentions two qualities. One is prakasha, and the other is happiness, or satisfaction. So prakasha means knowledge, but it doesn't mean knowledge of material things, because so many people get knowledge, all human beings get some knowledge. And so this means spiritual knowledge, at least knowledge that we're not the body, we are atma. So sattva-guna, the guna itself for the human, generates atma-jnana. And the whole process of jnana yoga actually is dependent on sattva-gun. So in 11th canto of Bhagavatam, Krishna explains to Uddhava different things and different modes of nature. And he says in sattva-gun we get jnana yoga. Jnana is the result of sattva. So this is it's a material product. In other words, jnana yoga is a material product of sattva-gun. So anyway, one gets this spiritual, if one follows the Varnashram system and becomes brahminical and sattvic, then naturally one becomes inclined to investigate about atma as opposed to body. And the other characteristic of the person in sattva-gun is happiness. So that happiness is defined as happiness within, not happiness externally, which means that he becomes detached from material happiness. He does not strive all of his life to get material objects for his happiness and his welfare, as people in tamagun and rajagun do. So in other words, the person in sattva-gun becomes detached from material things. So this is a system that is established by the Manus to naturally encourage the population to become inclined to spiritual interest and become detached from the material world. Though at any one point in time, the majority of the population is generally in the tamasic and rajasic states. So the sattvic or brahminical portion is a small percent, maybe less than 5%. But hope is that through that system, gradually, over many, many generations, consciousness will evolve upwards. So it's an encouragement for the human beings to evolve upwards over many births until they become sattvic and understand they're not the material body. Then they practice spiritual life. So that's one system that is established by Brahma. He is described that he created the Manus, particularly for this system. So in other words, the Supreme Lord does not leave the living entities helpless in the material world, simply enjoying or fighting with each other, etc. He has a certain plan, and therefore he makes Brahma create Manus to create the system for gradual purification of the population. So the Lord is not indifferent, and Brahma acts only as his servant. So this is called the Visarga, the secondary creation, because ultimately a Brahma gets his powers from Supreme Lord, and without that he cannot do anything. So that, of course, is also described in the second canto of Bhagavatam, where a Brahma wakes up and he doesn't know what to do, he doesn't know where he is, and then finally he hears a voice that says Tapa, and he begins to meditate on the Supreme Lord, and then the Lord reveals himself, reveals the spiritual world, and he gives him Shakti, by which he could start the material creation. In other words, Brahma is dependent upon the Supreme Lord. Whatever intelligence Brahma has been given, and whatever skill that he shows in creating the different bodies for the living entities and the different planetary systems and making all arrangements for them, it's actually coming from Supreme Lord. He's an instrument only. Brahma is an instrument of Supreme Lord. So this is secondary creation. So though it is Brahma doing the immediate job here, ultimately it's the plan of the Supreme Lord that is being implemented by Brahma. So all these different creatures are created, and among them we have some which are, of course, quite valuable for the upliftment of the human being, such as the Manus. And then we have another group, they're the sages, and we have different types of sages. We have some sages interested in the karmakanda aspect. So they propagate sacrifices and going to Svargaloka, etc. So we may criticize that, you know, karmakanda useless, etc. But it's a step over the other process, a demonic process of enjoyment. The demons, they stop the sacrifices, they persecute everybody, and through sinful activities, they try to enjoy in this material world. So at least those who do the karmakanda, they do punyas. They minimize sinful activity in order to get their enjoyment. So of course that's a very low stage, but nevertheless there are some sages dedicated to that. And then there's other sages, the great rishis, who are more renounced, and that's what's described here. The sages were also created as his beloved sons, and these sages are endowed with samadhi, yoga, riddhi, tapa, vidya, virakti. So they have detachment, they have knowledge, they have tapas, austerity. They have yoga siddhis, they have samadhi, etc. These are a group of renounced sages. So they're not going to teach karmakanda. They'll teach the opposite, renunciation of the material world. We have different facilities created by Lord Brahma for the advancement of the living entities. So the Manus do the initial work of establishing Varnashram people and raising people up. And along with them, we get some sages encouraging karmakanda and sacrifices and sattva, etc. And then we get other sages encouraging renunciation of the material world, yoga, etc. So in this way, we have a system of karma yoga, for general elevation. Then we get a process of Jnana Yoga, once you're in sattva, to understand that you're not the body, you're the Atma. And along with that, we get the Astanga Yoga process to make a little practical process to realize that you're the Atma. And then finally, we get the process of bhakti. So all of these are given, there are certain persons assigned to do this within the material world. Of course, for bhakti, we have many devotees, and one of the primary devotees is Narada Muni. He is a jiva, but he's also a Shaktivesh avatar of the Supreme Lord. So he's especially empowered. And his empowerment is bhakti. So he's, we see throughout the Bhagavatam how Narada Muni gives mercy to many people, like Margari the hunter, etc. And through that, very quickly, those devotees advance. So that is a special empowerment. Of course, he also empowers others. Even the Manus are empowered entities. They're not called Shaktivesh avatars because their empowerment is temporary. So they're called Vibhutis of the Lord. So the Manus are called Vibhutis because they're given special power by the Lord to do their work of establishing Dharma. And the great sages, those involved in Karmakanda, those involved in renunciation and Jnana, they are also Vibhutis of the Lord, empowered. And the Devatas also are Vibhutis of the Lord, empowered. Jivas empowered by the Lord, given temporary status. And every 71 Yuga cycles, the post is given, Jivas take the post and they do the role. Then next Manu starts after 71 Yuga cycles. A whole other set of persons take up the role of Devatas, take up the role of sages, etc. They all keep shifting 14 times in one day of Brahma, taking up these roles. So plenty of people get the opportunity to participate. If they think they want that post, they can get that post and do the work. So 14 times in one day of Brahma, we get a rotation cycle like this happening. So very ingenious setup produced by Lord Brahma under the direction of the Supreme Lord for elevation of the jivas upward through karma, yoga, karmakanda, varnashram, to jnana yoga, stanga yoga, and finally to bhakti yoga. So the Prabhupada here in the purport, he comments on detachment is necessary for spiritual development. So we see that detachment in one sense is inherent in sattva itself. The person is more interested in internal development, understanding the Atma, so he's less interested in enjoying in the material world. So that's one easily identifiable quality of a person in sattva gun. He's not so inclined to work madly in the material world for material gains. He's disinterested in that. So that's the quality of sattva. So, of course, we know that sattva gun is also binding. So people in sattva gun get bound to sattva gun qualities and they have to get born in the material world again. So it's not exactly liberation itself, but it's encouragement towards liberation, since Atma Jnana itself evolves out of sattva gun. And the process of Jnana Yoga originates in sattva gun also. So there is that sense of detachment. If that detachment goes to the extreme, as we'd see in yoga and Jnana Yoga, then it becomes the goal of liberation. Complete detachment from everything in the material world, and stopping the material body, stopping karma, stopping identification with everything, stopping eating, sleeping, mating, defending everything. So that's absolute detachment. So we call that mukti. And that also is one of the goals, artha, dharma, kama, and moksha. So in general, people will think, okay, yeah, moksha is the goal after we go through karma, etc., karma, artha, dharma, kama, all that, then we get to moksha. So people will think that's the goal, simply stop the process of birth and death. However, it's actually, that's incomplete. And therefore, Lord Chaitanya says that the fifth goal is prema, it's beyond moksha. The other interpretation, of course, is that moksha has two meanings. One is the impersonal moksha, the other is prema itself, that moksha itself means prema. Liberation from the material world actually means prema. So in any case, we should not mistake and think that simply becoming detached from everything and stopping material existence and becoming completely separate from the material body is the final goal. No, it's only another step, as is karma yoga is one step, jnana yoga is one step, astanga yoga is one step, and then finally we come to bhakti, and we perfect that as prema. So, detachment is there, but if it goes to the extreme, then we end up with this stopping with moksha, or impersonal liberation. And therefore, in the Bhagavatam, as quoted in the Nectar of Devotion, Rupa Goswami says that the qualification for bhakti is not to be too materially attached, because if we're very materially attached, either we're just regular enjoyers in the material world, or we start karmakanda and we do karma yoga, etc., and we never get out. He says, so we should not be too attached. And we should not be too detached also. So, too detached would be the other extreme, that we get involved in jnana and astanga yoga, and then finally we just get moksha and we stop there. I'm free from the material world. So either extreme is considered not so favorable for bhakti. On the other hand, a person that has some material attachment, but not too much, is allowed to practice the process of bhakti. He doesn't have to be perfect. To practice jnana and yoga there's a certain requirement, and that is sattva-gun, which means some natural detachment. And if you're not at that level, don't practice jnana. And therefore, jnana yoga is usually reserved for the Brahmins who study Vedanta Sutras and Upanishads, which is Shruti, actually. So it's quite some high qualification necessary for that. Bhakti requires some detachment, yes, but not extreme. And therefore, everybody's allowed to practice it. Anyone in the Varnashram system, and even people outside the Varnashram system, were probably very not detached at all. They're outside, not following many rules. They're allowed to start the process of bhakti. So, of course, not too attached to material enjoyment. If we're very involved in material attachment, what this means is that we completely identify with the material body and with our enjoyment. So bhakti cannot take place. So the qualification for bhakti, another way of saying it, is shraddha, or faith. And what does faith mean? Still we have our material attachments and whatever, maya, but at least the atma has evolved to the stage where it recognizes, I'm not the only person here and I'm not the enjoyer. There's a Supreme Lord, he's the enjoyer. That is the initial acceptance in faith. Of course, we still got all those desires and attachment to the material world, but at least there's a little recognition there of the Supreme Lord, and that I'm not the enjoyer, he's the enjoyer. So that little bit of, that's the enough, not too much in material enjoyment. A little inclination to give to the Lord instead of getting for himself, taking for himself. So that's a qualification for bhakti, at least faith. Based on that, then one can begin the process of bhakti, like hearing, chanting, remembering, etc., through the mercy of devotees in scripture. And gradually, the attraction to the Lord and acceptance of the Lord increases. And consequently, the idea that I'm the enjoyer must decrease. So that is how we trace the development of bhakti through anartha, vritti, nishtha, rupshya, sakti, and bhava, and prema. Gradual increase of the atma's attachment to the Lord and giving him enjoyment, and consequently getting less enjoyment for ourselves. So the process of detachment, therefore, is a natural process with the development of bhakti. So we don't have to unnecessarily restrict the senses and do whatever like that. It naturally will happen with the process of bhakti. And in prema, then there's zero attachment to anything in the material world. So it's a natural result. So therefore, in the first canto, it says that jnana and vairagya are a natural result of bhakti. They manifest naturally, not that they have to be practiced or whatever. So that is why Rupa Goswami says that this renunciation, tapasya, austerity, vairagya, detachment, practice of detachment is not an anga of bhakti. It is somewhat favorable in the beginning, but it is not an anga of bhakti, like hearing, chanting, remembering, etc. Why? He said, because it dries up the heart. What does that mean? It means that through that practice of renunciation, which becomes fogu vairagya, we lose our attraction for the Lord, and we become attracted to impersonal liberation instead. That's what happens. So the practice of renunciation is, we can say, a natural result of the process of bhakti itself, and it reaches a perfection in prema. Nevertheless, we do have to keep in mind that idea of not too materially attached also. So that is why we do have regulated principles, that we have some minimum standard that we keep in terms of detachment. So, of course, for a person living in the modern world, this is kind of, that's too extreme, too much detachment. But from the point of view of the yogi, that's nothing, you know. The yogi who lives in the Himalayas and doesn't eat anything, or maybe eats once a month or whatever, and he's doing samadhi all day long. He's in 9 hours samadhi a day or whatever. It doesn't wear clothes and whatever. Doesn't have a house and just lives in a cave, whatever. So that's real detachment, you know. So this is the minimum we have, which may look a little harsh for the people of the modern world. But in ancient societies, in the ancient Varnashram system, this was not very extreme at all. In fact, all the Brahmanas would follow this, and even the Vaishyas and Kshatriyas would follow to a large degree. So nothing too extreme originally, but in the modern world, it looks like too much tapasya and too much renunciation. So anyway, we have this standard, which is set up, which actually isn't bhakti itself, but it assists bhakti. So we use those things which are favorable to bhakti to help us in our devotional development. So one of these things is the minimal requirements of restricting the senses, etc. So we don't become too attached to material enjoyment. So this is one of the aspects, which is taken from the Varnashram system. In this way, the devotee does not overly renounce, and he actually uses objects as long as it is for the service of the Supreme Lord. Then it becomes acceptable. And that we call yukta vairagya. Things which are used for devotional service. On the other hand, the yogis and the gyanis generally reject everything. And of course they don't serve the Lord anyway. So they just minimize activities, minimize possession of objects and use of objects completely in the hope of controlling the senses and becoming completely detached from everything. So the process of bhakti, therefore, ultimately is an easier process and a more gradual process in which we don't have to suddenly renounce everything. We don't have to be first qualified with sattva gun or anything. The process of bhakti allows us for our attachments and living in the material world, but by the practice of bhakti, we gradually lose our attachment to these different things in the material world. So it's called sahaj vairagya, or natural detachment, natural renunciation. In the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna, or Arjuna, says to Krishna, now you've explained to me this whole process of doing karma yoga, and then when we are advanced, we do jnana yoga, etc. And then you explain bhakti yoga. So then we have this system of gradual elevation from karma yoga all the way up to bhakti yoga. But then he says, should I follow that system, or should I just do bhakti yoga? And then Krishna says, this other system is full of difficulties, Krishadikara. Very difficult to do, especially when you get to the jnana section. So better you just do bhakti yoga. So though the whole system is laid out with karma and jnana and yoga and bhakti, as one system for gradual development. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna advises Arjuna, just forget about that and just do bhakti yoga. That's what you do. Don't try to go through the gradual system. So then, of course, the question is, well, how can we just take to bhakti directly? Because we need shraddha, we need faith. Faith can arise at the bottom in tamogun, or rajagun, or sattvagun. It doesn't depend on sattva to get shraddha. To get atmagyan, yes, sattva is required. But to get shraddha doesn't require sattvagun. Very interesting. So therefore, anyone can take to the process of bhakti. Inside the Varnashram, Sudras, Vaishya, Kshatriya, Brahmana can do it. Chandala can do it. Malecha can do it. Everybody can do it. Because it doesn't depend on gunas at all. So where does it come from? Shraddha. Mercy of devotees. So devotee will be merciful to everybody. I mean, every guna. And gradually they develop some inclination. The Atma develops some inclination. And then they have shraddha, whether you're in tamaguna or not. So that's the miracle of bhakti. It's so flexible that it can sprout up anywhere in the material world. It doesn't depend on the gunas at all. Only mercy of devotees. Of course, the mercy in the beginning is generally accidental. Because if we don't have any shraddha, we're not looking for Krishna, we're not looking for anything spiritual at all. We're kind of avoiding it. So the devotees have to seek people out and give them mercy, even though they don't want it. But if they refuse it, then there's no mercy. So it has to be accidental. So that's the first step in preaching, accidental mercy. Just expose everybody somehow to Krishna, whether they're conscious of it or not. Somehow they hear the name, somehow they get prasadam, somehow something happens, and they don't even know what it is, but it happens, and it has an effect on them. It has an effect on the Atma. So that gradual exposure to Krishna somehow or other gradually gives a favorable inclination in the Atma, of becoming inclined to the Supreme Lord ultimately. So that's the power of even accidental bhakti. So that's the first step. Once they get faith, then we can do direct engagement, preaching, etc. in the person. But it doesn't depend on the gunas at all. So in Kali Yuga, of course, the whole system of Varnashram, and then going through that, and then getting to Bhigama Brahma, then do Jnana Yoga, Astanga Yoga, is actually not there anymore. It's very difficult to look for the remnants of the Varnashram system, even in India. Maybe there are, you could probably count the number of Brahmins on your fingers who are actually following properly the rabbinical codes. there's a few priests maybe in the temple doing this, but very, very, very difficult to implement that whole system. Especially for the lower parts. Maybe there's a few Brahmins that do it because they don't require so much support. But then what about the Sudras and the Vaishyas and the Kshatriyas? Who's regulating them? And there's no king, etc. Very difficult to implement exactly. And you need that system for many, many, many lifetimes to advance from tamogun to sattvagun and then take to jnana, etc. So that's a rather difficult process to implement in Kali Yuga. Other yugas they could do it, but not now. So therefore, Krishna recommends the process of bhakti. It is a direct process. And not only direct, and therefore quicker in that way, we don't have to go through the other processes, but it is quicker because it accomplishes whatever the other processes also do, but more. And therefore, Krishna says, very quickly, I will deliver you from the ocean of samsara. So to get rid of karmas, to get rid of ahankara, desires, etc., the jnani and the yogi, they have to strive for many lifetimes to do that. And Krishna says very quickly, it happens with bhakti. And why is that? It's because of Krishna himself. The Lord is involved in the whole process. He is not involved in jnana, he's not involved in karma yoga, etc. He leaves that up to the different other people to give instructions in the whole process, the gunas, etc. That's self-endeavor, etc. They can do that. But the process of bhakti involves Krishna himself. So in the process of bhakti, bhakti itself is actually part of Krishna. Bhakti is the Sarup Shakti of Krishna, the most important part of Sarup Shakti, Khladini, and Samvit Shaktis of Krishna. And the Lord allows that to enter into the jiva. So actually, when the jiva is doing bhakti, and he develops his bhakti, more and more, it's actually the presence of part of the Lord himself
in the jiva. Huh? Right? The Lord is very attracted to that bhakti in the jiva. And finally, the Lord surrenders to that devotee in prema. Huh? Krishna Karshani, sixth quality. Huh? In prema, Krishna surrenders to the devotee. How can that be? Because he's Supreme Lord. Because the devotee is also Supreme Lord in the sense he has bhakti in him. Bhakti is part of the Lord himself. So it's part of, you know, it's all internal. He's attracted to the devotee because the devotee has bhakti, and the bhakti is actually part of Krishna. So there's no criticism of the Lord that he surrenders to a devotee because it's actually part of Krishna in him. So the Lord himself is very attracted to bhakti even in its smallest stages, with Shraddha and a little bit of even mixed bhakti or whatever. Even though, of course, Krishna says of the four types of people, you know, the Gyanis the best and I prefer the devotees doing pure bhakti, but he even helps the mixed bhaktas like Gajendra. He doesn't do that for the Gyanis and the Yogis. He doesn't appear and rescue them. He doesn't rescue the Karmis, the Gyanis and the Yogis, but he will rescue even the Karma Misra Bhakta like Gajendra. Or he appears before Dhruva, who is also interested in getting a kingdom, etc. So, what to speak of those practicing pure bhakti. So, the Lord takes a personal interest in the devotees even at the stage of sadhana. And he helps them. And he gives them guidance. I give thee the intelligence by which you come to me. So he inspires the devotee to take the right choice and make the right decisions, etc. He purifies within. He enters the heart of the jiva and destroys the anartas. That's because of Krishna himself. He destroys the anartas. So Krishna is acting for the devotees at all times, and therefore the process becomes much easier and much quicker. So automatically the liberation from the material world takes place. But the devotee is not so interested in that. He's more interested in developing his attraction to the Lord. And the Lord also helps that whole process by his personal arrangements. So therefore, without regard for the other processes, if we just take to the process of bhakti, we get all success. So all this is arrangement of the Supreme Lord through the creation of Lord Brahma. The Lord is not indifferent. He makes all these arrangements. But the best arrangement, of course, is the devotees of the Lord who give out bhakti, and the Lord himself manifests himself as avatar in the material world to give inspiration to those devotees. So these are the very direct ways in which the Lord encourages bhakti.
Okay. Any question?
It's a combination, a mercy and endeavor, in all cases. Yeah? I think Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he explains in one place that in the Ramanuja Sampradaya, they have this controversy. Is it mercy or is it endeavor? And they give the example of the cat and the monkey. Yeah? So one group says it's like the cat with the kitten, and the cat simply takes the kitten and moves them over here. So it's basically a mercy thing, that by the mercy of the Lord, you advance and you go to Vaikuntha. And the other group says, no, it's endeavor. We have to put our endeavor for it. Like the baby monkey has to hold on to the mother when she jumps from tree to tree. So it's endeavor of the baby monkey. So we have to put forth our endeavor. So there's that controversy within the Sri Sampradaya. Is it endeavor or is it mercy that you get your deliverance from? So then Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur takes the example of a man drowning in a well. He's in a well and he's calling out for help. So another person comes along and he sees him in the well, and then he throws a rope into the well. But that's not enough. The man has to grab onto the rope also and hold onto the rope when he gets pulled out. If he doesn't do anything, say, mercy, 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 and looks at the rope, he'll drown. So he also has to hold on. There is some endeavor involved. Yes, mercy is involved. And without the rope, he can't do anything. But if the rope is there, he has to put some endeavor into it to hold onto the rope. So he says it's a combination of mercy and endeavor. Yeah? Of course, also on a very high level, of course, that's also explained in the Dumbadar story, where Mother Yasoda had tried to bind up Krishna, and it was two fingers too short each time. No matter how much rope she got, it was always exactly this much, two fingers too short. So Vishnu Chakravarti says the two fingers means that without these two things, you cannot tie up Krishna. In other words, you don't get prema. And you don't control Krishna in prema. Huh? Two things. One is endeavor. So Krishna saw that Mother Yasoda was endeavoring, and she endeavored for many hours. She got more and more rope, and she kept trying to tie up Krishna, and Krishna said, no, I'm not getting tied up. And I was two fingers too short. But after a lot of endeavor, then Krishna also saw Mother Yasoda is getting very tired. Huh? So then he became attracted. Yes, I think I'll be merciful to Mother Yasoda. So by the endeavors that the devotee puts forth, then the Lord's merciful. But without that mercy, of course, still Mother Yasoda could not tie up the rope. But therefore, Krishna said, okay, now I will allow myself to be tied up. So he gave mercy because of the endeavor. Huh? And this way, the rope was tied up. So therefore, endeavor and mercy are both necessary to catch Krishna. So therefore, it's a combination. Huh? And that mercy takes two forms, devotee's mercy and Krishna's mercy. Hmm? Both of the things are there. Hmm? But we also have to put forth our endeavors, not just depend completely on, you know, mercy. Huh? That's called Kripa City, where we do very little and suddenly we advance. But that's rare. An example of that is, of course, we get people like Putana, got killed by Krishna, and she went to the spiritual world and became a nurse. No endeavor, opposite endeavor. She tried to kill Krishna, and she got the opposite result. So that's, you know, it's a rare thing. And other example, of Murghari the hunter. In 3 months, he got bhava through the mercy of Narada Muni. He didn't do that much. In 3 months, he had bhava. You know, usually it takes a lifetime to get to bhava, but he got it in 3 months. How? Mercy of Narada Muni. Yeah. Mercy of devotee. So that's Kripa City. Yeah. But that's rare. Yeah. Usually, we have to go through the sadhana process. But in that process, we get mercy of devotees in various forms of mercy. Plus, we also get the mercy of Krishna. Hmm? But it's not sudden, as in Kripa City. So it's more gradual. Well, in the Karmakanda, they recognize devatas. They also have to recognize Vishnu. And we see that Vishnu is always part of the sacrifice, even though they're worshipping devatas. They also have to worship Vishnu. So there's a recognition of the Lord there, at least official recognition, even if it's not their primary deity or whatever, and they never offend him. So, okay, Vishnu is supreme, but we're doing our thing, we want to get our material enjoyment. So there's some recognition, even though it's not, you know, prominent. So recognition is that's the amount of their bhakti. Huh? And by that, they get svarga wherever they want to go. If they reject Vishnu in that whole process, they don't even get svarga loka. Whole process doesn't work. Huh? So that's for the karma, kanda karma yoga. In Jnana, if one rejects the Lord and says, okay, as the Shankara's people do, Mayavadis, the form of the Lord is material, then it becomes offender, and they cannot get liberation. As I said, one thinks one's liberated, but he doesn't accept the lotus feet of the Lord, and he falls from his position. So that's the position of the Mayavadis. Other Brahmavadis, they will accept, yes, the Lord exists, and they will even worship him. They'll worship devatas and whatever. They're not Mayavadis, so they say it's actually everything's real, even Vishnu is real. But they still want liberation. As we see with Sukadev, before he came out of the womb, you know, okay, even though Krishna existed, he wanted the Brahman state. So some people are like that. And if they really want the Brahman state, and they also accept the Lord and worship the Lord a little bit, the Lord will give them liberation in impersonal Brahman. They can stay there. But if they offend the Lord, they don't. They fall. So therefore, in Jnana, a little bhakti is also necessary to get liberation, permanent liberation. If they don't do that, they fall. And the same with the yoga. So these processes are actually dependent on some recognition of the Lord and some bhakti. Bhakti is not dependent on the other processes. You can mix it a little bit, but even if it's not there, no jnana, yoga, or karma, kanda, varnashram in your bhakti, still you can get perfection. It's independent. It's non-material. That's why we have devotees also. and Krishna speaks to those devotees also. So the external, we have the internal guru, the Chaitya guru, internal guru, that's Krishna speaking, Paramatma, etc. And then we have the external guru. So we have devotees, guru, other devotees outside who also kind of reinforce the message for us. Practice-wise, of course, there's an emphasis in the Ashtanga Yoga on the asanas, pranayama, dharana, jhana, etc., meditational process. In jnana, they may do that also, but their main emphasis is jnana, studying Vedanta Sutras, studying Upanishads, a logical process, etc. So it's largely an intellectual process. And to support that, to realize the Atma, then they also carry out renunciation, tapasya, things like that, austerities, etc. And they may mix a little jnana in there also. So you may have some people who are a mixture of jnana yogi also, in that sense. But it's a matter of emphasis, actually. And in general, the goal is the same, the impersonal liberation, or both of them. Of course, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says the yogi is superior to the jnani. He doesn't explain why. I would think one is that in the yoga process, the jnani actually must use meditation on the Lord as part of his process. So at least a little closer association with the Lord, whereas many of the jnanis reject the Lord completely and therefore they fall from their position. And the yogi should also depend on Paramatma and through that he can get his samadhi, etc. But unfortunately, once he gets the samadhi, then he rejects the Lord. Says, I'll just enter into Brahman or something, or enter into Paramatma. So then that's another problem. So generally they have the same, more or less, impersonal goal. Maybe they're actually devotees in some sense. They're giving good instructions like that. Because it's all Krishna's arrangement. He inspires them to give instruction. Of course, you see in the 11th canto, there's the story of the different things like the bumblebee, etc., giving instructions to the person, you know, like that. They're all acting as gurus. So if one is intelligent, one can pick up instructions even from the material world. What to speak of people who directly give good advice or whatever. So, yeah. Yeah.
But so what constitutes bhakti in those modes? Are they different?
Oh, yeah. So, yeah. We can start the process of bhakti through shraddha by being in any guna. Now, then we have a choice of what type of bhakti we want to do. And in the third canto here, and Kapila describes tamagun bhakti, rajagun bhakti, and sattvagun bhakti, all of which he discards as being useless because they're materially contaminated, mixed. So one should do pure bhakti. So though one is in tamagun and one gets shraddha, if he has good fortune, then he practices pure bhakti. And through the process of pure bhakti, he transcends the gunas. Because bhakti itself is beyond the gunas. Now, of course, because he was in tamogun, then he may be influenced by tamogun, and he may practice tamogun bhakti, which is not so good. So the bhakti is there. It itself is pure, just like the sun is pure. But today the sun is covered by clouds. Of course it's not if you go up in an airplane. But from our point of view, it is. So the person in tamogun, the bhakti is not impure, but his mentality is covered by tamas. And therefore, in his performance of bhakti, the effect of the bhakti becomes weakened because of his tamasic mentality, desires, etc. And that will tinge his goals in bhakti. So he will do bhakti in order to get tamasic goals, like destroying other people or whatever. When he was in Rajagun, then he will use the bhakti to get material goals. And if he's in Sattvagun, he'll use bhakti to get liberation. So that's the mixture of the gunas. It will create these different things which are not pure bhakti. It becomes mixed bhakti as a result. So nevertheless, if one gets good instruction, no matter what guna, we can practice pure bhakti. And that is why Rupa Goswami gives that definition at the beginning of the Nectar Devotion. This is what we practice. And if someone is fortunate to get that pure bhakti and start like that, no matter what guna he's in, then he advances beyond all these things. Well, in a sense, we do have pure bhakti. That's the whole thing. The definition of pure bhakti is given in the Nectar Devotion, Anya Abhilasha Shunya, etc. And we start with our sadhana, we start that pure bhakti. So we're practicing pure bhakti. In other words, when we do our chanting and our hearing, we are not implicitly saying, I'm chanting in order that I get my material desires fulfilled. Is that our goal? No. We're trying to get prema, serve Krishna completely. We're not pure, you know, we've got an artist, etc., but at least explicitly, we're not striving for material goals or liberation. So that's what we call pure bhakti, even in sadhana. Of course, in prema, it's literally pure because there's no an artist at all, and it's only for Krishna. But even now, we call this pure bhakti. So that process of pure bhakti will take us to these different stages of anartha nivritti, nishtaruchi asakti, where the anartas, desires, etc., gradually decrease, 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 decrease. So it's a natural process. But as I said, generally, we also have a minimum standard we set for ourselves, like regulated principles, to control the senses, etc. And then over that, then we do the whole process of bhakti. So following regulated principles, like the minimum standard of avoiding anartas, you can say, for us. And keep a minimum of detachment.